Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we talk to neighbors who have an interesting story to tell. And today we begin with an Ohioan who has made a name for himself in Ohio politics and spent some time in Washington, D.C., and also happens to be a five-time Jeopardy champion. Joining us is Richard Cordray, former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Welcome to All Sides.
Glad to be with you, Amy.
So you helped form the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau back in 2011. Now the department has been told by the Trump administration to halt much of their work. It looks like dozens of employees will be losing their jobs. What did you think when you heard about this order from the president?
Well, I think it sounded an alarm. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was put in place 15 years ago in the wake of the financial crisis that cost millions of people their homes, millions of people their jobs, hurt a lot of families in Ohio, obviously. And the Consumer Bureau has been there to provide safety and stability in these consumer markets ever since. And it has done a good job doing that.
So most recently, the Bureau has been working on privacy issues with fraud, especially with mobile payment apps, Apple Pay, PayPal. Elon Musk's company X has been working to get into this space. So some have said that it's a conflict of interest for him to shut down this place, this program.
Well, it's clearly a conflict of interest. President Trump has said that Elon Musk will not go near areas that affect him. But that's not true in the case of the CFPB. The CFPB does regulate payments and the payment markets. And Elon Musk is trying to enter the payment markets with a co-venture with Visa. And he would love to not have to be subject to any regulations or oversight. But that's not the way the law is supposed to work. That's not what Congress passed.
Now, the agency has grown a lot in its 15 years. I mean, you mentioned it started to help homeowners caught up in the mortgage crisis from 2008, 2009. But the department did work with student loans. The scope expanded a lot, right?
No, the scope was broad from the beginning because consumer financial markets actually are a big part of our lives. If you think about mortgages, you know, tens of millions of Americans have a mortgage to buy a home. If you think about credit cards, which most all of us use to manage our monthly finances. If you think about student loans, which are the primary means by which young people go to college these days. If you think about auto loans, which are typically very few people pay cash for a new car. Instead, they take out a loan. All of those products are overseen by the Consumer Bureau to make sure that people are treated fairly, that the law is being upheld, and that people can't be cheated or gouged.
Now, the Trump administration is trying to cut waste and redundancy in the federal government. So is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau a big department? Does it need to slim down?
Well, I think there's always reason to look at the government and see where you can root out any kind of waste or abuse. The Consumer Bureau is actually one of the smaller agencies of the federal government. If you've heard the discussion around AID, which had about 10,000 people. The Consumer Bureau has about 1,700 people. It's about the size actually smaller than the Ohio Attorney General's office. And yet it has a big mandate to protect consumers across all of these financial markets, which can be so complicated and so dangerous for consumers if they're being taken advantage of. So what they have done so far, as I understand it, and it's hard to keep up, frankly, with the rapidly unfolding events, is that they have cut the probationary employees, which is about 70 employees out of the 1,700, and they're pruning here and there. But I do believe that the Consumer Bureau will continue to function. They have nominated someone to be the new director of the Consumer Bureau, which suggests that they intend to allow it to operate as Congress has provided. It would be illegal otherwise. And we'll have to just see how things unfold.
Okay. So as of right now, you feel like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will still exist. It just might look a little different.
It will exist because it's in the law and Congress specified it. There's 150 pages of federal statutes governing exactly what the Consumer Bureau is, what it does, what it shall do, which is mandatory, and the executive branch has to carry that out. And so, you know, the fantasy that you can just wave your hands and make congressional laws vanish because you don't happen to like them, that's not the way our system works. It would be a tyrannical change in our system of government, and it's not something American people will want to allow.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. We're talking with Richard Cordray, former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You wrote a book that goes in depth about why this agency exists, Watchdog, How Protecting Consumers Can Save Our Families, Our Economy, and Our Democracy. What do you worry if the watchdog doesn't get to do all of its watching anymore? What do you worry about?
Yeah, Amy, I think that book that I wrote, Watchdog, is actually a pretty good guide to understanding why, hasty action here and ill-considered action here would be so harmful to American consumers. I mean, we all have the experience of dealing with the fine print of mortgages or the fine print of these credit card, packages that have 27 pages of different provisions for this and that are very hard to understand, all of which we know somehow in the back of our minds uneasily we feel could cost us money and will cost us money at some point. And to have an agency that is trying to simplify all of that, clarify all of that, look through it and make sure that people aren't being taken advantage of is very valuable. And it has actually saved and returned $21 billion to consumers over the last 15 years, where financial companies had broken the law, taken advantage of people, extracted money from them that they should not have been allowed to extract, and we have gotten that money returned to families like yours and mine. And that really matters.
Now, you spent a lot of time here in Ohio, in Ohio government in different aspects, and then you transitioned to national government with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. More recently, you worked in the Chief Operating Officer of Federal Student Aid under the Biden administration. What was that role like?
Yeah, that's all the financing for higher education. We talked about student loans and grants, Pell Grants, and the like. And by the way, I just, on the intro to this show, they were talking about the hearing they're having with the new education secretary, and the president has vowed to shut down the Department of Education. Again, that's not something that he can do without congressional approval, but it's certainly a goal of his. And we'll see how that comes out. They're still going to have to finance higher education. The notion that you will tomorrow shut down the Department of Education and stop all funding, loans and grants for students across this country, which is in the billions of dollars, and that schools will be able to survive is just a fantasy beyond belief. So, there's a lot of talk in Washington, a lot of big talk right now. Some of it will come to pass, much of it will not, and it's important to kind of wade through it and be a little patient with some of these grand hand-waving pronouncements.
Now, Washington, D.C. has obviously changed hands, so that changed what you're doing, right? So you are currently back here in Central Ohio, and you're a law professor at Capital University Law School, correct?
No, my wife is a law professor at Capital University Law School.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I must have misread that. What
no,
are you
no,
What
she,
are you doing
a,
now?
She's a very good law professor at Capital University Law School. Exceptional in my view. I am doing again some financial consulting work and quite a bit of consumer advocacy work around the country. One of the things we did during the first Trump administration was we built and strengthened consumer protection at the state level. Across the country, California, New York. In California, we created a mini CFPB, got that approved by the legislature there. In Colorado and New York, we have strong banking regulators who can step in and take the place of the CFPB if it's in retreat. And that's an important element of our federal system, is the states can do a lot if the federal government's not doing its share, and vice versa. And so that's one of the things that we're making sure is happening around the country and will happen again under this next term of President Trump.
Do you have any future political plans here in Ohio?
Not at the moment, no.
Do you want to run for governor again?
I'm not here to talk about that today. I'm here to talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is under siege and an alarming threat in Washington, and I think needs to be fortified and understood and embraced for the good that it's doing for American families all over the country.
Okay. Yeah. We do this segment every Thursday called Fascinating Ohio, and we found that you are a fascinating Ohioan, and you know, your job at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was in the news. So I was just curious, you know, Amy Acton is running for governor. Do you have any advice for her since you have experience in that area?
I don't. And again, I'm not really here to give political advice today. I'm here because there's a crying need in this country to stand up for some of the institutions that matter to families across the country. One of the things the Consumer Bureau did was it set up a complaint system so that individuals who couldn't get relief from their financial companies that had cheated them could go somewhere and have somebody look at their problem and solve it on an individual basis for them. And the Consumer Bureau did that time and again. And if it were to go away, if it were to be deleted, those people would have no place to have recourse. And that would be a very backward step for fairness to consumers.
In your consulting work that you're doing right now, I mean, you mentioned creating a mini bureau in California. Are you working with other states as well or here in Ohio?
Not so much here in Ohio, but yes, we've worked extensively with state officials in California, in Colorado, in New York, in Pennsylvania, in Virginia, in Connecticut, Illinois, you know, again, mostly what are known as the blue states. They're the ones who have more interest in consumer protection, and some of the other states seem to have less, although there are plenty of issues on which they do try to stand up and protect people. You know, one of the ways to understand this, Amy, is that consumer protection is also a law enforcement issue. It's a matter of making sure that everybody is held to equal justice under the law, and that the biggest and most powerful financial institutions, which often are ones who think that they can get around the law or get exceptions to it or get favorable treatment, to make sure that they're being treated on the same level as everyone else. And that kind of even-handed law enforcement is a principle that I think the Consumer Bureau stands for, just as we stand for it in the areas of criminal law and criminal prosecution of people who break the law everywhere else in our society.
And do you have any plans to work in Washington with helping the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? I know you said it's an act of Congress, so it has to stay in some form or another, but there have been a lot of lawsuits filed. Do you have any plans to help with that, just to make sure that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is still meeting its what is in the law that it needs to be doing?
We'll see. Look, this is very early days of the Trump administration. You know, President Trump has not even been in office for a full month yet. I mean, it seems like more than that because he's been so active. But in terms of where this is going with the Consumer Bureau and its leadership and, you know, what it will be doing, what it won't be doing, again, much of that is governed by what Congress has said in the law. And again, under the Constitution, the president and the executive branch are required to see that the laws are faithfully executed and therefore not to set them aside or ignore them. And we'll see how that goes. But, you know, I am an advocate, fierce defender of the Consumer Bureau. And I wrote the book Watchdog to tell its story and to help people understand why it's important and how it protects their families and how I think it also protects our democracy. And so I will continue to stand up strongly for that wherever I think it's under threat.
Okay. And just in the minute we have left, I always love reading in your bio that you're a 5-time Jeopardy champion. Any plans to return to Jeopardy?
I have always been willing to go when they have asked me. You know, the only question is whether they will ask me. But it's a terrific show. And I loved Alex Trebek. I think many Americans loved Alex Trebek, even though he was originally Canadian. And Ken Jennings has stepped in and done a superb job as the host. And it continues to be just an oasis of sort of peace for about 20-25 minutes on a nightly basis from all of the political wars.
Thanks to Richard Cordray, former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and as always, a Jeopardy champion. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, Amy.
And this is Fascinating Ohio on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. Their Instagram page describes them as three dudes from Ohio who like to detail cars. With more than 1 million subscribers on Instagram and YouTube, they're not the only ones who like car detailing, especially when those cars are barn finds that haven't seen the light of day in a long time. Here with the dirty details behind the YouTube channel is RJ Wagner. Welcome to All Sides.
How you doing, Amy? Thanks for having me.
So, RJ Wagner, you are part of WD Detailing. Can you tell me how you got involved in detailing cars?
Well, funny enough, my first job that I've ever had was working at a car wash at 14. I rode my bike up there, applied, got the job, and I guess that's the inception of my passion for detailing. And then it's evolved over time. I ran a mobile detailing business when I was in school for accounting in college. The accounting career did not exactly pan out the way I thought it was going to. And so I kind of came back from school and continued to detail. And then we eventually started making videos on some of the dirty cars that we'd find through our through the detailing business. And then WD Detailing ended up kind of being born from that.
So you have a YouTube channel, you have an Instagram, WD Detailing. And what made you decide one day to be like, oh, I should take a video of this? I think other people should see how dirty this car is.
That credit goes to my business partner almost solely. At the time he was working for me at my detailing business, and he had always been very fascinated with social media. He even had a small following himself, but he had been interested in detailing as well. Started working for me and said, "Hey, like we should really try filming one of these cars. I watch a lot of content online of people detailing, and I think it would be cool to try and make a video." And so we had tried a couple times at customers, on site. It was a mobile detailing business, so a lot of times we were on, in someone's driveway trying to film a video. And that is very difficult to do. Filming takes almost twice as long as like a typical detail job, just because you have to move the camera and get the shot. So we eventually decided in February of 2020 that if we were going to actually try to make content, we would set up dedicated days where we would find the dirtiest car we could and then film the whole entire process and really, really give it our full attention, at least for that day out of the week. And then we would post our videos online, one per week. I guess the story goes is that we posted our first video February 28th of 2020. And then we posted one a week. We posted one a week every week for 5 years straight now. But our third video ended up getting 1 million views. And I told Brent, I go, we are not going to stop this unless it's detrimental for or some other aspect of our life, our health, or, if someone, if we needed to find, if we couldn't pursue the dream anymore due to other reasons, then I guess we would have stopped. But I told him we're not stopping. So, and of course, everyone knows what happened in March of 2020.
Right.
A lot of people had to stay home and watch YouTube or Netflix. So I guess, it ended up favoring us as much as it didn't favor the rest of the world.
Maybe people were at home during that time and they were able to be like, I should really take a look at that old car I have sitting in my barn right now. And then that inspired them, you guys. So basically, you find people contact you, I guess, and because they have a really old car that just hasn't been touched in a long time. You go out there, you take some video. But I watch some of these videos. I mean, some of these cars are amazing, but they haven't been touched in decades. Does that surprise you? Does it ever surprise you that someone has this car and they haven't touched it?
Not anymore. But that's just because I've done, we've made over 230-ish long form videos on YouTube. So You know, it's actually funny you ask that. I've always wondered what the mindset is of I understand some cars. I as a car guy myself, I've had a project car that, you know, is not worth as much, or that would it would cost more than the car is worth to get it back on the road, but you know that you're going to lose money when you sell it, and there's some factors that play a part of, I guess, your decision making on I guess leaving a car to sit for so long. But you know, the car that I had was very cheap. It was only a couple, you know, $2,500 when I bought it. But some of these cars that we work on, you know, for example, one of them, it was a Ferrari 512 BB, which is a
saw that Ferrari video. It was abandoned for 28 years.
I don't know how you do that. I mean, that car is it was a very, very cool Ferrari. It was actually the precursor to the Testarossa. It had the big 80s, you know, rear end with the rear engine, as well as, you know, the kind of iconic Ferrari circular taillights. And it was just such a beautiful car, and it was just kind of left to sit there. And it wasn't even a money or a health, you know, a health issue, which it, usually when people leave cars like this, it becomes, or it's because of them, their health failing them, or life, you know, kids, getting married, having kids, you know, moving, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes that takes precedence, which I guess it should over your sports car. But this gentleman had, you know, he was wealthy. He did have lots of other cars. But yeah, it behooves me to see some of these iconic cars that we were lucky enough to find sitting there, especially the very, very low mileage ones. And I might be rambling a little bit right now, but we'd actually find, this is the craziest find that we've ever found. It was a garage in Southern Ohio. It was an old farmer who had bought three of the same Corvettes. They were both C3 Corvettes, and they two were 1978s, and then one was a 1982. And
is that the one mileage, that is that the one that only had? Yeah, go ahead. I saw that video.
Yeah, I mean, just in this, I really don't understand. He thought that it would be a good investment to buy these Corvettes and basically not drive them. So one had 1,600 miles, the next one had 293 miles, and the last one, the 1982, had 33 miles, which is just...
Just three, listeners, just 33 miles. That's like down the road and back.
It still had the... It had the original temp tag and the plastic on the seat still. It just, you know, he never used them. And okay, you know, maybe the investment, I can understand someone trying to make that decision or trying to make that, you know, thinking that that was a good idea. But unfortunately, he did pick the wrong Corvettes. He could have put his money in the S&P 500 and done very, very well, very well, way better than he did on the cars. But the worst part of it, well, I guess the best part for us, was that he just let the garage kind of become dilapidated to where raccoons got inside. And when I say raccoons got inside, I mean like we literally had to use a front end loader to remove the amount of raccoon feces from this garage.
Oh man.
I'm talking hundreds of pounds of raccoon raccoon feces. It was insane. And the cars were, you know, they weren't covered. It wasn't heated. So I mean, really just kind of destroy these cars by leaving them there. And thankfully we were able to clean them up and make them look as like new as possible. And truthfully, they would have been great museum cars, because you're not going to drive a car that old with 33 miles on it and, you know, ruin the value of it. But, you know, I know for a fact, actually, that all three of those cars, granted, now they are covered because we bought him covers and we put moisture remover containers inside to make sure that they doesn't grow any mildew or mold. But I know for a fact that those cars are still sitting there, and he had good offers on them. So, long-winded way of saying sometimes the mentality just doesn't make any rational sense.
We are talking with RJ Wagner, the co-owner of WD Detailing, about the YouTube channel and the Instagram account that has more than 1 million subscribers. And do people hire you, but you also sometimes do this for free? Is that right?
We actually only, so I just recently made our actual service business defunct or closed it. I mean, I still will pay tax at the end of the year, but you know, I don't have the time to do the service business, the service side of things anymore. So yes, we only film videos for YouTube now, and we actually do all the work for free. And sometimes if it's the right car and the right condition, and we know that our viewers will really, really like it, and we need to kind of sweeten the pot to make the deal happen. We've even paid to do a lot of these cars.
Wait, please let me clean your car.
Yes, exactly. You'd be surprised how hard it is to get some people to agree to a free detail.
So, are they all in Ohio, or do you travel?
The majority, we try to stay local within you know, an hour or two drive of our shop here in Cleveland. But we've gone as far as New Hampshire, so Cleveland to New Hampshire, Cleveland to Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, Traverse City, Michigan. So we've, as far as we probably traveled is around 500 miles away from our shop. So we've become road dogs over time, I guess.
Now, some of these videos get a little emotional. I saw you fixed up a Dodge Viper for a man whose brother passed away. When his brother passed away, he left him the car, but that man had some medical problems and he just couldn't take care of it. It really needed some TLC. Can you tell me about that experience?
That it's very funny you say that, because we actually have a car inside our shop right now that's is that same gentleman's vehicle. He's actually become a great friend of the channel, and that's how we met him, was working on this Viper that his brother did leave him. But since we have we pulled that Viper out of his yard, we cleaned it up and then brought it back to him, because of that video, he had a childhood friend reach out to him that offered to paint the car for free. So that car is now freshly painted, has new tires, and he actually gets to enjoy it with his daughters. And he's a very good man, and he's been a great friend of the channel. And that's probably one of the most rewarding things about what we do, is we meet a lot of fantastic human beings that are all connected through, I guess, our love for our enthusiasm for, you know, cars and I guess cleaning cars. And so when we get to have stories like that, and we get to make connections like that, and kind of tell a story that that surpasses, I guess, the metal, glass and plastic that these cars are made out of, that makes it all very well worth it.
Yeah, you had him in tears because it just reminded him of his brother, right? You know, his brother wasn't here anymore, but this car made him think of him, and it looked brand new. So it's a lot of these cars that you work on, do they still run? They just need TLC? Like that one you just gave an example that it does work, right? Do most of them still work?
Most of them do not.
Okay.
If I'm being honest. And that's probably the next iteration. What we hope to achieve in the next couple of years is to try and find a way to probably make, because we make one video a week, and this is actually some behind the scenes information that I'm giving right now. But the goal is
it breaking news? Okay.
I think in the future we're going to start making less videos, but we're going to try and focus more on stories where, you know, it's a great car, a great person, and a great story. But instead of just cleaning it and bringing it back, because ideally, you know, our MO is to clean the car and give the owner the energy or the desire to go in that and take the next step to get it fixed. And so I think in the future we won't make as many videos each month, but when we do make these videos with the extra time, we're hoping to kind of incorporate actually getting the car mechanically running again and being able to share that experience with the owner of the, not only the car being cleaned and looking nice again, but then being able to go on a drive.
Would you entertain, I mean, some of your videos look like they're TV shows in the making. Would you entertain the idea of a TV show?
We had actually been approached, and thankfully we did not get accepted into the TV show. I think it was through Discovery. I don't even know if I have an NDA on that, but I don't care anymore. I think it's well gone. I think it's gone now, or I think the NDA is over now. But, you know, I'm glad that never transpired, because it's me, my business partner, Brent, and then my best friend, Mike, that filmed these videos. And we all have complete creative control, and there's no fabricated conflict between each other. It's very organic, and it's very authentic to who we are. And I don't think that having a production company or a studio that's, you know, saying, hey, we need you guys to do this, or what if we added this to the car? What if we made it dirtier? So I don't really know if there's even money that would be able to make us kind of sacrifice what we have here, because we own everything. We own every piece of it, and it's a direct reflection and extension of who we are.
And when you, in some of the videos I saw that you have launched your own product line, were you not finding cleaning products that you, that were working for you, that you wanted to create your own?
It was more so, so with complete transparency, we actually are working with the same company, because I'm not a chemist. And I would, if I tried to formulate my own products, we would not be doing well anymore. So I'm actually working with the same company that I've worked with for the past 10 years, and they're local here in Ohio. And we actually get to be a part of the formulation and the blending process. So we went through their full catalog. We made some changes to around 8 products. You know, we found the product and then kind of made them ours. We added more surfactants to make their more foam or this scent or remove this, et cetera, et cetera. So it's cool because although you know, technically is a private labeled company, or rather product, we have much more control with this, with our products than a lot of companies do. So the long or the short winded way of saying is, we've actually curated this line to be the best products that we could possibly curate. And, I'm very proud of it. We put a lot of work into it. And, like I mentioned, my good friend, Michael, who works for us in WD Detailing, is a business partner in WD Auto Supply. So we wanted to make sure that everyone has a piece of ownership and can feel like they're working towards something bigger than, I guess, all of us.
So if someone's listening to us now and they have a old dusty car with a backstory, how do they get in touch with you?
So the best way to get in touch would be to go to, or rather to email us at wdbarnfinds@gmail.com and send us a picture of what car you have and send us where you're located. And please send the picture, because some people do just tell us what they have, you know, through text. And it's very difficult to answer all the messages. So we try and kind of prioritize the ones that have pictures. So if you do have anything, particularly 70s, 80s, classic American cars or classic German cars, or Japanese cars, really anything that you think is very cool, send us pictures and send us where you're at, because we're willing to travel. We do all the work for free. We're fully licensed and insured. We trailer the cars and we clean them for free. And a lot of people all around the world enjoy the content.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amy.
You are listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and that was R.J. Wagner, one of the co-owners of WD Detailing. And this is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we talk with neighbors with an interesting story to tell. It can be hard for parents to navigate their children's school lives, from all the communication coming their way to homework, to attending parent-teacher conferences and other events, even making sure their kids get to school each day and on time. Some families face greater challenges than others in these situations, and that's where Vernell Bristow comes in. She's the Southside Parent Engagement Coordinator for Communities in Schools, Ohio. And in her off hours, she's a poet, and she works to promote arts in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides, Vernell.
Thank you, Amy. It's so wonderful to be here today.
And you have worked with Communities in Schools, Ohio for almost 7 years. How does this nonprofit work to help parents become engaged with their children's education?
Yeah, it works in two ways. The first way is that Communities in Schools in Ohio partners with local school districts to place coordinators inside schools to work with students full time and to also work with their parents through family engagement. I do something a little different. Mm-hmm. I'm the Southside Parent Engagement Coordinator. So I work with parents that live in the 43206, 43207 zip code areas in Columbus, Ohio. And I work with them with being a better advocate for their students in school, for their children in school, as well as how to create a learning environment at home and when they go out into the community.
So those zip codes you mentioned, that's Marion Village, Old Town East, the King Lincoln, Bronzeville area, and German Village, right?
Yeah, and 43207 goes down as far south where it borders Groveport and Obetz. Mm. So that's a big area.
So you have a diverse population that you work with. Are you working with K through 12?
Yes, parents of students K through 12. It doesn't matter what school the children go to, as long as they live in that in those areas.
Okay, so if they could go to public school or a private school, a charter school.
Yep.
And so your goal is to help the parents be engaged with their children's education. What are the families facing that they what do they tell you they need help with?
Oh yeah. First, let me say that sometimes there's non-academic barriers that can impact students' education. So I will also work with parents on those areas, too. Lately I've been encountering some parents who are having some housing instability, parents who are looking for a job, looking for a better job, want to change directions to better provide for their students. And also, too, talking with parents about making sure their kids have a great attendance, great experience with their teachers. Some parents struggle with communicating with their child's school. So I would definitely help them with that, help them with how to ask certain questions to kind of get the information that they want and how they can better support their students' education.
I can tell you, as a Columbus City Schools parent, navigating Parent Portal for the very first time is hard.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
You get used to it eventually, but yes.
Yes. And so some parents do have a challenge with that. They may have a challenge with using that technology, but that's where all the answers are in terms of how your child's doing, what their grades are, how they're progressing. This year, they moved busing and transportation information into the Parent Portal. So I'm always encouraging parents to not be afraid to engage the technology on their end. They can't break it. So click the buttons, you know, and engage. And whenever Columbus City Schools has sessions online that teaches parents how to navigate that, I encourage those parents to take advantage of those sessions too.
The absenteeism and dropout rate continues to climb across the U.S. and here in Ohio. But your organization, Communities in Schools, shows a 93% graduation rate for seniors. What can your organization attribute that high percentage to?
Oh, man. I'm not a site coordinator that works inside the schools, but I can't speak to that experience in working one-on-one with students every day because I work with parents in the community. But what I do know is that Communities in Schools Ohio, our motto is being present matters. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's those site coordinators in the school building relationships with students that contributes to that high rate, because they are building relationships. They're being a trusted adult that student can turn to. And so I believe it. In fact, when I leave here today, I'm going to go and see all the site coordinators right away. So and I'll be glad to be among them. They work so hard every day.
Can you tell me a story of working with a parent where you felt like you made a difference?
Oh, yeah. You know,
pick one. Yeah,
yeah. I will pick one. So very recently, I've been working with a parent who is an absolute gem. And she felt the need to give back to her community. She saw that other women and moms, you know, were kind of struggling. And so she wanted to start talking to other women and other moms about self-care, good mental health, how to reduce the stress. And so she formed a grassroots organization and started meeting with other women and other moms monthly. And it just blossomed into something bigger. And over the holiday season, they got together and they're giving back to the community. They're doing food baskets and or what they would call love boxes and giving school supplies, you know, at the start of the school year. And this is a parent who has her own children, two school age children, who struggles with some chronic medical issues. And even when she's not feeling best, not feeling well, she's still looking for ways of how she can serve other people. And her and I have been having conversations about that. She has a desire to take her grassroots to a nonprofit status, 501c3. So I shared with her some workshops that were happening in the community that could help her with just that purpose. And her and a few of her friends started going to those workshops and really appreciated those that resource. And in the midst of all of this, back to school giveaways, holiday support to the community, she found herself struggling with housing instability, having fallen through the cracks, you know, as a person who has a chronic medical issue, you know. And throughout that whole time, you know, I was able to be a resource for her, a sounding board for her, a listening ear for her, you know, and then it all worked out. She's in a great new home, continuing to serve the community, hadn't missed a beat in her service with other people. And I'm proud to know her, proud to work with her. I mean, she's amazing.
This is Fascinating Ohio, and we're talking with Vernell Bristow, the Southside Parent Engagement Coordinator for Communities in Schools Ohio. I'm sure that you've had some parents who have had some not so great experiences with the school system. How do you help them navigate negative memories?
That's a big issue, because sometimes when parents didn't have the most positive experience when they were students, bring that into the relationship with their children's school. And so I just remind them that they are empowered in that situation, that they are a part of their child's educational team. No one knows their child better than them. And so try to shift that focus from having an adversarial relationship with the school, even when the school is disappointing them, to really, you know, telling them that you are empowered in this situation. You have choices, you know, and be in it to win it. Like, be in it to win it with your child. Push through whatever issues there are so that the child's education is being taken care of, so that teachers and parents and other resources in the school, like counselors and social workers, are all on the same team. So I'm just trying to speak positivity with that and maybe give them some other information, resources to help shift that focus into being a team player.
Do you work with the teachers at all, too, to try to be a middleman?
I do not. Mm. You know, if a parent wanted me to go with them, I certainly would, you know. But I happen to have so many teachers in my life. And so sometimes when I have a hard situation, I will call upon them and say, hey, here's the situation. What advice would you give me, you know, from a teacher perspective, so that I can help this parent navigate what they're experiencing with their child's school.
The pandemic highlighted the need to be tech savvy, to help students learn online. It really brought out the digital divide, where there are some people who just did not have high-speed internet access. They didn't have the proper devices that they needed. Can you talk about how this is manifesting itself with the families you work with?
Wow. You know, I don't know any specific families that I work with who are having a problem with technology, because they all seem to be okay in that area, you know. And I always remind them that sometimes the phone in their pocket, you know, can give them the access to the most information that they may need. You know, I do talk to them about how to use that as a resource. If their children are working on homework, you know, and they need some information, they just need to look something up, you know, your phone is a computer. Like,
that's true.
I know. Even saying the word computer might date me a little bit, might age me a little bit. But I do remind them of that. Like, that can be a resource for you. And if they get to the point where, like, if a laptop dies, you know, sometimes that's the challenge. Like, they have a laptop or tablet of their personal use, and it dies, and they may not be able to replace that right away. Now, that is a situation. And I remind them how wonderful it is that we have such a great library system in Central Ohio with the Columbus Metropolitan Library, that they can go to the library and they can use their resources to, you know, when they need to get them over the hump, so to speak, until they can get their own technology restored.
And we briefly talked about absenteeism and school attendance earlier. What do you tell parents about the idea of, like, you need to be there and be on time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remind them that that's their responsibility, mm-hmm. is to get their children to the door, you know, into the building, you know, and the teachers will take over from there. But they also need to be concerned about what's happening in there. But that is their responsibility to do that. And if they're having challenges with that, to reach out with the school as soon as the challenge comes up that may cause the child to miss school or be late, miss hours, you know, communicate with the school. Because good communication can solve a lot of problems between parents and the school.
How many families would you say you're working with right now? Do you have just a more than you can count?
Yeah, no. Throughout the year, I will work with about 60 different families. Mm-hmm. But at any one given time, I will be working with about 20. You know, some will rotate in and rotate out, and then a core that will stay with me all year.
Do they come to the nonprofit you work for, Communities in Schools Ohio? And then they get assigned to you? How does that work?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question, Amy. Thank you for asking that. I partner with a church, and that church is nonprofit on the South Side. Mm-hmm. It's called Family Missionary Baptist Church. Their nonprofit is called Reaching Higher Heights for Life. And many of the parents that I work with have children that participate in their outreach programs. So they have a summer camp during the summer. And so I work with those parents on the summer camp, retain those parents throughout the year. And then I also have parents who will refer me to other parents. And then I will also get invited sometimes to participate in community events where I can have a table set out, where I get to meet new parents. And that's always really wonderful. That's the primary way that I meet parents that are what I consider Deep South Columbus, the 43207 that bumps up against Obetz and Groveport.
Now, before we run out of time, I wanted to say that you are known in the arts community for your poetry and your lifelong love of it.
Yes.
Can you talk to me a little bit about your love of poetry?
Oh, my goodness. I love poetry. I've been writing poetry since I was about 19 years old, when I was a college student at Denison University. And that just blossomed into a love of poetry and also providing spaces for other poets. Just for almost 25 years, me and two friends, Scott Woods and Louise Robertson, hosted a weekly open mic poetry reading that allowed us to provide space for other poets. And that, you know, went very well. And, you know, and then we decided to pull that train into the station and end that in December of 22, which was right on time because I was pursuing a doctorate degree and needed the extra time in my life. But I'm still a poet. I still write poetry. Lately I've been writing some really wonderful poetry that I get to share in my spiritual journey with my church, and that's another dimension that I hadn't explored earlier in life, and so I really love that too.
You're a busy lady. What are you getting your doctorate in?
It is a doctorate of ministry with a focus on global Christian leadership in the urban context at Methodist Theological School in Ohio, out in Delaware, Ohio.
And you also, you told me before we came on the air that you have a couple of master's degrees, too. What were your studies?
I do. Now you got me sounding like a nerd, Amy.
Well, embrace it.
Yes. I have a master's degree in African-American African Studies and a master's degree in English Literature from The Ohio State University.
How do all those degrees tie into your work with parents?
Oh, yeah. It's really wonderful. I think one of the reasons is because that degree in African-American African Studies. Now I'm about to date myself, because when I got that degree, the department was called Black Studies.
Okay.
But that degree is multidisciplinary. And so it is you know, you were, even though you were taking classes in that department, those classes in traditional disciplines were like English class, a sociology class, an economics class. And so it got me, it trained me to look at things from all sides.
Oh, that, you tied it right back into my show. Yeah.
Yes. And so here now, you know, in my work with parents, yeah, I do have to look at things from every side. You know, every parent that I work with is different. It's not one prescribed program that I give them. When I meet a parent and they want to work with me one-on-one, that parent is telling me what their goals are for their family, and then I'm going to help them reach those goals, whatever they may be. So one parent might be trying to find ways to better budget their money. Another parent may have something directly related with their child's school. Another parent may be dealing with some grief, you know, that they need help with their children doing. So, yeah, that's how it helps.
Thanks to Vernell Bristow, the Southside Parent Engagement Coordinator for Communities in Schools Ohio. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And this has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.
Morning.